these murky waters on the River Hamble lies some remains of a medieval ship. But this isn't just any old ship. We're hoping this is the Grâce Dieu, Henry V's huge flagship. In fact, it was so big that no bigger boat was built for another 200 years. But amazingly, she only ever had one voyage. And after Henry V's death, she was just abandoned and left to rot. So was she too big to sail? Was she a failure? And how much of her lies under here? We've got just 3 days to find out. On a bitterly cold night in January 1439, the Grâce Dieu was lying silently at anchor, surrounded by three smaller royal ships. The story goes that this huge royal battleship was struck by lightning and burnt to the water. Strangely enough, the other ships weren't damaged. Nearly 600 years later, the skeleton of a huge ship is still visible on the bottom of the river. John Adams, who was one of the leading archaeologists on the Mary Rose, has no doubt this is the Grâce Dieu. So how are you going to prove it?
We're going to put a trench over the stern and look at a part of the structure that we think most information is going to come from in the time available to us.
On a practical note, how the hell are we going to get the dirt out?
Well, we're going to excavate, essentially, just as you do on land, with trowels, paintbrushes, etc. But we'll suck the spoil away with a water suction dredge, and that has the effect of keeping the visibility a little bit clearer.
Francis, you're musing.
I am, Tony. I mean, how did they get such a socking great ship up this little river and then get it lodged in the mud?
Well, they cut what we call a mud berth. And that would have been a big trench into the side of the riverbank, probably cut at a very low spring tide. And that would have allowed them to get another 20 metres into the bank, and so that it would have still allowed traffic to carry on past.
Phil, you've got a luxury on this one. You don't have to wait for geophys to finish before
brilliant.
You start digging.
Brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. No, but I also don't have a big yellow digger, do I?
We could drive one in if you like.
Henry V was the most powerful king in Europe after defeating the French at the Battle of Agincourt in 1415. In just one day, the English wiped out most of the French nobility. Even though Agincourt was the last great land battle of the Hundred Years' War, the French and their powerful allies, the Genoese, posed a continual threat on the seas with their huge warships called carracks. Henry V kept his Royal Navy here in the Hamble River. Unlike Southampton, which had been raided several times by the Genoese, the Hamble was a safe anchorage, protected from the invaders by a chain across the river mouth. Three miles upriver lies the ancient port of Burselden. And a mile past Burselden, four royal ships, including the Grâce Dieu, were laid up in specially dug mud berths.
John has been talking about this wreck as though he knows it's the Grâce Dieu, but we don't know that, do we?
Oh, yes, we do.
How?
Well, we've got a great deal of documentary evidence which makes it quite clear why, when it was built, how much it cost and who built it.
But, Susan, that just says that there was once a boat called the Grâce Dieu, not that this is it.
Oh, but one of the documents tells us that it was brought up the river here, anchored in the river for some years, and then eventually beached on the mud flats over there.
Well, OK, Susan, so it did sink here at some time.
Not that sink, it was beached.
Well, OK, it was beached here at some time. But that doesn't mean that what he's found is it. It could be another medieval boat.
No. It couldn't, could it, John?
It's too big to be anything else. There is 40 metres from stem to stern of the structure in the mud. And we know that that's not all, because the original ship would have been much, much bigger. So the dimensions people have come up with are anything up to 200 feet or more, in fact. 60 metres long by about 15 metres wide. 50 feet wide.
That is a hell of a size,
isn't it? 200 feet long, 50 foot wide. To me, that seems too big. I mean, looking at the plans that were made in the 80s of just what they could see on the surface then, it's very difficult to stretch them to fit those dimensions. I think somewhere beneath that, perhaps, 40 metres, 45 metres long, so 40 feet wide, something like that, rather smaller, but still absolutely enormous.
Damien, are you saying this isn't the Grasse Dieu?
No,
or are you just saying that they lied about the size?
I'm just saying the historical way of deriving the size is different to the archaeological way. The archaeological way is to go out there and measure it. The historical way is to follow the documents, which are difficult to understand.
So we are looking for an enormous ship. She carried a fighting force of at least 200 men, and we think her forward castle, or forecastle, was 50 feet above the waterline. That's three times the height of a double-decker bus. But as our experts can't agree about most of the other dimensions, one of our targets is to define her actual size. But why did they build her so big?
It had to be larger than the largest ship the enemies of England could throw against it. And those were the Genoese carracks, the big Mediterranean sailing vessels of the allies of the French. And the Grasse Dieu is about three times as large as the largest carrack.
Our first job is to get the geophys underway. And here we're using the latest deep-sea sonar technology. Depending on how much of the hull is left in the mud, this might tell us how long this ship was. But this system has never been used in such shallow water before.
What sort of depth do you normally work at?
We normally work in about 10 to 20 metres of water, but most of my colleagues think that is ridiculously shallow, let alone this.
See, I mean, how does this actually work? How is it that this thing can pick up wood? How does it work?
Well, basically, if you sort of send a sound source down to the seabed, the physical property change between the water column and the actual sediments is pretty significant. You get an echo back from it. And what we've found out is that there are also big physical differences between the wood and the sediment, so we also get an echo from that. So hopefully we'll get echo both from the seabed and maybe wood buried beneath it.
And you should actually get a 3D image of the boat.
Well, that's what we would hope to do anyway.
This is the first time that this wreck has been excavated by divers. Once the diving begins, two of them, including John, will be working flat out for hours on end. But before anyone can get in the water, there's a huge amount of preparation to do. These safety checks are essential, but they're swallowing up our valuable time.
Function checks completed, all working correctly.
Check 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Loud and clear.
Yeah, loud and clear also.
We think that at least 17 ships of Henry V's Royal Navy were maintained and overhauled at Burslesdon, a mile towards the sea from our site. Stuart would like to know more about this busy village in the time of Henry V. With so much royal business, Burslesdon docks must have been a focal point for trade. If Stuart can locate the medieval shoreline, then he can begin to piece together the layout of the ancient port. The tides in the river churn up all sorts of silt and weed, and the underwater visibility is very poor, so John has designed a special enclosure. This paddling pool-looking device is called the sea curtain. Once anchored over the trench, the sides can be let down and secured to form a tank. The water inside can then be pumped out through a filter and returned into the enclosure, clear of silt. Well, that's the theory, but it's already taken half the day just to inflate it and get it in the water. It's just after lunch and the tide is slowing down. John's getting ready to dive.
Chin up just a little bit, mate. Yeah, in, fingers.
Everything else is ready. Each diver has a companion on standby in case there's a problem.
Contents gauge. Carabiner.
Suit inflation.
You okay? Get a diver in the water, please.
But there's little point in Phil and I taking the place of the two working divers until the visibility is far better and they've started to uncover the wreck.
Left surface.
John has chosen to dig across the stern of the ship in a trench about 2 by 2.5 metres. The depth of water at the moment is only 2 metres, but the tide's still running, the visibility is extremely poor, and there's a huge amount to get ready before the serious archaeology can begin. John's still positioning the anchors for the seeker.
I was rushing around like crazy till just after lunch, and now everything's just gone, ugh. That's really frustrating.
Why?
What? Well, nothing's happening. Look at this thing. It took them hours to blow this up, and it's just been sitting in the water forever.
Well, look, no, I mean, I disagree with you. I mean, I know it's disappointing. I want to go and see this boat. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it looks like at least I've got my feet in the water. But, I mean, look, this is a difficult exercise. A lot of it is experimental. That has never been tried before. So, I mean, we've got to get it out there, we've got to test it, and we can't run it until we've done all this.
The first people to investigate the wreck were the Victorians, who thought the Graf Skjer was a huge Viking ship because her hull was clinker-built. This was an ancient technique using horizontal overlapping boards, still used today in small boats. The wreck diggers noticed the old ship's hull was made up of not one, but three planks of oak fastened together with huge ship's nails. Nothing like this had ever been seen before. And not surprisingly, archaeologists since have been asking questions. To understand just how this royal ship was built and the problems the medieval shipwrights faced with a ship of this size, Damien is going to reproduce a very small section of this extraordinarily complicated hull.
How long would it take to make a plank like this, do you reckon, if you knew what you were doing and were doing it all the time? Not that I'm suggesting you don't know what you're doing, but you know what I mean.
It's a little bit cheeky, but...
I was just trying to get an idea of how fast work was likely to progress.
Well, if they knew what they were doing, small ones like this, they would make, I don't know, 10 or 20 a day if they had very good straight pieces, which this is reasonably straight and regular and nice and fresh, so they'd make a hell of a lot. If the material wasn't as good, it would take longer, you know.
John's finally got the site prepared. He's had problems sighting the anchors for the sea curtain, and he's been marking out the trench underwater. On the surface, Phil has been waiting patiently for his instructions.
Phil! Can you hold it there and then I'll come and get it? You'll come and get it!
We're so nearly ready to go, but no end of optimism will make up for the fact that we've probably lost a whole day just getting the site ready.
Can we pass that line to the diver? Yeah?
There's a total with the King's donation added in as well, so you've got £4,000 here.
Carenza's looking at the quantity of materials and manpower used to build the Graf Skjer and the time they took to construct her.
Here, which is the original, which has...
What's that?
Well, it's a kind of summary of all the accounts from the building of the Graf Skjer and all the other...
There are no diagrams or shipwrights' plans, but there are copies of some of the 15th century commissioning documents and accounts.
So there's a huge amount of detail in this, and then there's various other documents that people have gone through.
And the realisation of what it took to build an enormous royal ship is beginning to dawn.
The scale of it is just kind of unbelievable.
By the end of our first day, at least a picture of this huge ship is beginning to emerge from the history. And the first glimpses are even beginning to appear from under the silt.
OK, well done, yep. John. Are you well?
Yep, diver well.
Diver well!
Roger that. Could you see much down there?
Yeah, quite a bit, actually.
Like what?
I could see about a metre and a half, and by the time we finished, we cleared off about 2 metres of the ship's structure, so you could clearly see the black timber against the seabed.
But we are a long way behind, aren't we? It's been such a frustrating day.
Well, these things always take a bit longer than expected. But no, I think we've done quite well, really. We've got the trench in the right place, the enclosures moored down, the boat moorings are all set, so we could carry on and do a night shift, but...
You're so cool and so relaxed, and I tell you, they're all champing at the bit out there. Are we going to get to see this wreck? We'll find out tomorrow.
It's the beginning of day two on our excavation of Henry V's huge flagship, lying here on the bottom of the Hamble River. Yesterday was so frustrating, not being able to see anything, having to wait for the site to be prepared. But this morning, conditions are far better. Low tide's about 2 hours away, and that means optimum visibility. The sea curtain can also be anchored down soon, so shortly they can begin to exchange and clean the water. Happily, the dredge, used for sucking away the mud and silt, is working perfectly. And inch by inch, the ship's hull is coming to light for the first time in over 500 years. With Susan and John's help, Raysan is working on a 3D picture of how the grass dure might have looked. For the first time, we can see how overpowering this 15th century battleship might have been, and what a huge advantage it could have provided for Henry V over his enemies. Building a clinker vessel of this size was very complicated. Rather than building the frame first, they started by forming the ship's hull with layer upon layer of triple boards, and when it was complete, they fitted the frame inside. The clinker boards were clenched together with huge iron nails and washers called roves, and the hull was then fixed to the frames using tree nails, long wooden pegs that were driven through both the boards and the frames and wedged at each end. To join the boards end to end, the shipwrights cut overlapping scarf joints. We don't know if these joints were staggered or how long the boards were. To the modern eye, this appears to be a really cumbersome way to build a ship. And why did the medieval shipwrights use this triple clinker construction in the first place? To find out more, Damien is looking at some of the timbers that were salvaged from the grass dure in Victorian times and which are now kept in Winchester Museum. What's it telling you?
It's telling us a lot about the tools the shipwrights used. You can actually see fine detail of tool marks in this scarf joint here where the boards joined end to end.
Where?
And even the little places where the nicks in the blade, sharp as ridges, on the surface of the timber. That is just superb preservation.
And what are these things here?
These are the iron washers for the end of the bolts or rove nails that held the ship together. On the inside, we can see traces of tar. And for me, one of the most interesting things is we can see how relatively rough the finish was. I mean, this is a royal ship, but they were building her fast and they weren't obsessed about the finish by any means. I mean, this is really quite rough.
What's going on here?
Well, this is part of a frame timber. I mean, it's again, fantastically well preserved. You can see shipwrights' marks, you can see...
What is that, Damien? Is that a sort of the carpenter's mark to show it was his bit of timber he needed to be paid for? Or is it a sort of kit number of how to put the ship together?
It's probably got most to do with how the frame timber fitted in the ship. The shell of the planking was built first, frames put in afterwards. But you can also see some pretty crude work here.
Yeah, what is this?
Well, these crude scallops are to fit over the heads of the bolts, and they're cut pretty crudely and very deep. So they're going bang, 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 chop, 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 chop. The clock is ticking. You know, this is speedy work.
And Damien, is this going to help you actually try and reconstruct how it was put together?
It is. I mean, I'm already beginning to realise that we've been wasting our time making the boards as smooth as we have on our section we're building. And you know. It's just fantastic. It's just the beginning of understanding. I can't say what it's telling us.
He's always so taciturn. It's really nice to see him excited.
Oh, no, I've been a student of medieval shipbuilding for several years, and this is just fantastic material.
The tide's beginning to slow down now, and that means optimum visibility.
John, you're wet!
I'm wet. I had what they call a wet dip.
Phil's been put on standby, and he's really excited.
Is it all right?
We're nice and productive now.
And how's the skirt doing?
Well, the tide's still too high for that to be operating. That's still about a metre above the seabed. So we're just operating down on the seabed below that at the moment.
But is the excavation going up to according to plan? Is it as just...
Yep.
It's plain sailing now, is it?
We've gone down this much already.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So what's the plan? Why aren't you still in there?
I've just come up to change hats.
And then you're going back down.
I'll borrow this one.
Permission denied.
In 1420, 5 years after the Battle of Agincourt, the Grâce Dieu was finished and ready for sea. She was the biggest, most prestigious warship that had ever been built, and probably amongst the first royal ships to carry guns. Were the Europeans impressed by it?
Oh, yes. I mean, this is one of the nicest things about the Grâce Dieu. The Florentines used to come to Southampton every year with galleys to trade. And Soper, who's the guy in charge of the royal ships, was also a merchant. So he met up with his contact and took him to dinner on the Grâce Dieu when it was in Southampton. And this guy wrote it all down in his diary. And then he says, it was the most beautiful ship I ever seen. Well, that was real praise from a Florentine.
She set sail in July 1420 on her maiden voyage from Southampton to the Isle of Wight.
Presumably the sailors who worked on it must have been terribly proud that they were on this great ship.
Well, you'd like to think so, but have a look at this. This is an account of the muster of when they were going on the only expedition that the Grâce Dieu went on.
A muster is just like making a list of them so you know who to pay.
That's right, a roll call in effect. And if you look here, this tells us that how the quartermaster of the Grâce Dieu is William Duke of Dartmouth of the Grâce Dieu. He threw the muster roll into the sea when they asked him for it.
The crew were underpaid, the weather was appalling. Some of them who weren't used to handling such a large ship just wanted to chuck it in.
And they insisted on being put ashore on St. Helens in the Isle of Wight. And then things got even worse after that. They attacked one of the servants of the guys taking the muster and tore his clothes, and it says they used verbis contumelis. Otherwise, they swore at him.
You know, I find this so refreshing. When we're doing archaeology, we're always going, oh, what a great imposing structure. Look at the size of this boat. But actually, there were ordinary people on it who were really hacked off.
Absolutely.
They wanted to go home.
They wanted to go home. I mean, weather was clearly dreadful. They may have been afraid that this vessel was not seaworthy, though there is no evidence whatsoever for that.
So after only one wretched voyage, the Grâce Dieu was anchored in the mouth of the Hamble to deter enemy raiders. Eventually, she was berthed upriver and her masts and rigging taken away. She was never to see the open water again.
They had shipkeepers on these ships, like caretakers, and we know, in fact, that the superintendent shipkeeper was Jordan Browning, who was a very experienced royal shipmaster. He'd been master of the Holy Ghost. He was a Southampton man, a local man. He superintended the building of a little royal ship down the river at Basildon called the Little Jesus.
Well, Stuart's our man on the spot. If he can work out where the medieval village was, then the boatyard could be somewhere there.
232 in the main, all functioning correctly. Ready to hack the diver? You happy, Phil?
I am overjoyed. I can't tell you how long I've waited for this.
Good.
It's mid-afternoon on day two, and Phil's moment has finally come.
You happy?
I am absolutely happy.
Diver two ready to enter the water.
But there's a problem. John hasn't been able to secure the sea curtain to the river bed properly, and the water exchange isn't working. So Phil's going to have to take a chance with the visibility. Tony to Phil, can you hear me?
You can hear you, Tony.
What's it like down there?
Like a pea super, actually.
Can you see anything of the boat?
At the moment, I'm attempting to find it by feel. I'm going to follow John. He said, follow me. And I'm going to stick it to him like a... Whoa, there he is. You've got to bear with me, Tony, because I cannot see a single thing. I cannot see a thing. The visibility is literally, it can be no more than a foot, maybe. I cannot see the boat, but I know it's here. And now he's guiding my hand down. Oh, my God.
This is like a radio programme, not television. What can you feel?
There it is. Now that makes sense. And that is a questionably grass jerk.
Damien's ready to put together his section of the triple boarded hull. He's just waiting on some nails he's ordered from local blacksmith Colin Phillips.
Oh, hi. Hi. Oh, my God, they're enormous. Frighteningly big. Unbelievable. And someone was telling me that you'd actually weighed these. And what sort of weight is that then?
1 pound and 8.5 ounces.
That's unbelievable. That's a huge amount of iron. And these are the rows. Brilliant. I mean, these are incredible. These are just so much bigger than the examples that we normally deal with. I mean, they're twice the size, basically. Now, the job will be to see if we can actually cut these and rivet them, because they are so massive. OK, thank you.
All right, then.
Less than 20 years after her maiden voyage from Southampton, the Grass Duer was struck by lightning in her mud berth and burnt to the waterline. 10 men spent over 3 months salvaging 8 tons of precious iron from her hull, presumably on the orders of her masters in Burselden.
Stuart, I bet you were a train spotter when you were a kid.
Absolutely not.
Come
no
on,
way.
I see no. you with that little thermos. Listen, over the other side, they were saying that there was this guy called Jordan Browning, who was the caretaker of the Grass Duer once it had been laid up. And he actually made ships just around here.
Mm-hmm.
What would this place have been like at that time?
Well, in the 15th century, well, obviously it wouldn't be as genteel as it is now, and there certainly wouldn't be a railway line here. But the present foreshore of the river, that's very much where it would have been at that period. And the waterline would have come through here to the edge of that car park there.
Yeah, yeah.
Run along to the edge of the car park over here to where the road is.
Yeah.
And then swept back out to there. It's like a huge creek. All this would have been creeks, mud flats, that sort of thing.
Do we reckon that Jordan Browning's boatyard could have been around here then?
Well, the one thing I'm reasonably certain of is that the focus of settlement at that period would have been in this area. The church is up on the top of the hill there, at the end of this creek, and that's where you'd expect the boat building to start from in that period. This would have been an industrial community, boatyards here, hammering, carts being brought backwards and forwards, that sort of thing. Lots of smoke, lots of activity.
Do you want to get the number of that train? So, Jordan Browning's boatyard could have been there.
So most of the boat building foreshore of medieval Burselden appears to be under the railway line. Tomorrow, Stuart's going to pinpoint the creek between the foreshore and the church with Francis, who can open some test pits. John and his team have been diving for 8 hours now and are making really good progress, even in the poorest visibility.
Because this is almost vertical.
Because the stern's about here.
The other
isn't
side
it?
Is just about here.
Yeah.
It's not far away.
These are really tough conditions, even for the most experienced divers. It's the end of the day, and we're waiting for Phil. So we've retreated to the pub. But Phil is the bearer of bad news. The sea curtain is a non-starter. After 2 days, John's decided to abandon it altogether. It's just not working.
I mean, we did spend a hell of a lot of time putting it in.
If we hadn't...
And installing it.
If we'd ignored it, if we'd gone in without it, we could have been diving, yeah, you know, by lunchtime today.
Yeah, but, you know, on the other side, you know, I mean, OK, it doesn't come as a great surprise to me, but, I mean, the main thing is I've actually been down here.
Don't let's be too glum. We may not have seen the Grass Duer.
Seen the
Grass Duer. You have not seen
it. I have seen it. It's about that far away, but I have seen
you
the Grass Duer.
You saw it like a short-sighted mole.
I saw it. As I live and breathe, I saw it.
Tomorrow, let's hope that we can see it a little bit clearer. And tomorrow, I'm going to get down and have a look at it, all right?
Yeah.
Beginning of day three in our search for Henry V's flagship, and yesterday was so frustrating. Phil managed to dive the wreck eventually, but the visibility was so bad he couldn't see anything, he could just feel it. And we had been proposing to put that orange sea curtain round it and pump it full of cleaned water to improve the visibility, but it wasn't the greatest experiment in the history of diving, was it?
Archaeology is all about interpretation, Tony. And I think it worked brilliantly, actually. We now have a working system, and I now know that that device will work really well in another situation.
So it was a great experiment, it's just that we can't use it here.
Well, in 3 days, it's just too much of a rush to get it deployed.
So are we going to be able to dive the wreck today in circumstances which will allow us to see it?
If you come in when the water's moving just gently enough to take away the sediment, then you'll see what I see.
I'd really love
fantastic.
To, mate.
Yeah. Now, we've been making great progress.
Show me what you have seen.
OK. Well, we opened up a trench across the stern of the vessel, and we've got a series of frame timbers coming up almost vertically, with the outer planking still attached. But what's rather nice about it is that we can actually see part of the construction sequence. These are the scarfed ends, the tapering ends of the planks. And this is one of the things that we've been wanting to find out, actually how long these planks are. So we can now follow those and find the joints at the other end.
What's this?
Well, this is to give you an impression of the three-dimensional setup of the structure that we've got. Here are the frames coming up, massive things. And this is the planking still in position, stepping down, sort of clinker fashion, down into the seabed.
Are we going to be able to get on any faster than we did yesterday?
Faster? You can't make me work any faster than I did yesterday.
We've been champing at the bit, and all the time he's so easy, so relaxed. I hope you're right. Let's have this conversation at 6 o'clock tonight.
Okay, right. Yes, yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Phil and I haven't seen any of this underwater yet. John's trench is 2 metres from where the ship's rudder would have been. He's seeing both sides of the ship's hull with the triple thickness planking tapering down to the stern post. The frame timbers here look as if they're 40 by 50 centimetres thick, which are far bigger than he'd expected. And John thinks there could be anything from a metre and a half to 2 metres of the hull still under the mud. Justin Dix has been processing his sonar geophysics results at the Southampton Oceanography Centre.
And it's really exciting, Phil. Even in this very shallow water, we've got a really good image. This, along here, is the actual seabed. And we can actually sort of add that on there. And then what we've got is a really strong anomaly, really sort of yellow and red colours here, very, very strong reflections.
That is a cross-section through the grass
dure. And that's actually cutting a slice through the actual grass dure. And in fact, the reflections are so strong, we get nothing, no sound being reflected back beneath. Whereas on either side, where it's just a sort of muddy sediments, we get sort of horizontal layers, sort of some basic layering within it. We're fairly confident that's the actual hull.
So, from a series of these cross-sections, you can put it together and actually build up the shape of the hull?
Well, that's what we've been trying to do over the weekend. If we go onto this screen here, what we've done is we've effectively picked the seabed surface so we can actually sort of have a sense of what the seabed's like. And if we go underneath here and we start to add the actual horizons, we can start to pick out the actual hull section. And if we then rotate round, you can start to see a sense of that hull form.
That's right. Here's the actual width of the hull, mm-hmm. and you see it's tapering back towards the stern.
That's right.
But how much of the ship have you got there?
We've got about 2/3 of the vessel here at this time. I mean, normally we would survey for a number of days and process for several weeks, so over a weekend we're pretty pleased with this.
You're pretty chuffed about this.
I'm over the moon, actually.
So here it is, a huge section of the Royal flagship still under the mud. If Justin can do some more work, we should be able to calculate the size and shape of the ship. Damien was expecting to build a larger section of the triple clinker hull, but he proved that it's a slow, messy business, sandwiching in the tar and moss that they used to waterproof this ship. Now he's got to fit it all together.
OK, do you want to tap those in? Just gently.
How many of these nails do you reckon would have gone into this boat? This size?
We can't say exactly because we don't know how deep she was, but thousands. We're talking about thousands. So, I mean, it's a huge amount of iron. These are not bedding down very well, are they? I'm wondering whether we need to cut a bit of a recess for that.
You got to whip them out again?
Afraid so.
Well, this is learning. I mean, yeah. This is learning by doing, and we're learning the hard way, I'm afraid.
Damien is not amused. It's all got to come apart again.
You know, two steps forward, one step back at the moment. But we're learning.
Are you happy?
After yesterday's pea super, Phil's hoping he'll see something today.
OK. Happy? OK, off you go. Derby two in the water.
Roger that.
Reports well. Derby two, red derby.
This is much more like it. The visibility's so much better. Here are the massive frames John's so excited about, and the side of the ship, which is dropping away to the right. There's a huge tree nail, which looks as fresh as the day it was driven in. And a scarf joint. One of the main tasks today is to establish the length of the boards that form the clinker hull. Colin McEwan, who's diving with Phil at the moment, is measuring one of the hull planks.
Right, could you just give me a measurement from the scarf joint at the end that's free back to the farthest point away that you can get? Okay. Understood?
Yeah, understood. Topside, diver one.
Topside.
Can you tell John the plank is 2.43 metres long?
This is a new discovery. Everyone thought the ship had been built using boards no longer than 2 metres.
2.43, roger that.
Stuart has been searching for medieval Burselden. Yesterday he found the outline of a dried-up creek below the church, which he's sure is the centre of the ancient village. Today he's identified a building on the 19th century tithe map near the water's edge.
It's this building just here, number 3. Now, if there's a storehouse there in 1839, and it's at the end of this feature here, which is the foreshore, that would imply it's up on dry ground, i.e. we're definitely on good land there. So it might be the sort of area that has a continuity of tradition that have been used for storage and so on. That might be a good place to examine.
Francis has got two test pits on the go. In this back garden, he's looking for the storehouse. The other he's put in just along the street to see if there's any evidence of the medieval shipbuilding on Stuart's projected shoreline. In 1422, Henry V died, just 2 years after the Grace Dieu's maiden voyage. She cost a massive £4,000 to build. You could have probably put up a fine cathedral for that at the time. And Robert Bird, the clerk of works of the ship who'd lent the king some of the money to build her, didn't do very well out of it.
So did he actually manage to get his money back and make a profit on building the Grace Dieu?
Very unlikely. I mean, here you've got the total amount received, and then down here you've got the total expended, and in fact it says rather sort of laconically he should have more, £65.12.08.
So he made a loss.
He made a loss. On this case, not a very big one, but still a loss. And his chances of getting this back were pretty slim.
Even though it's written down the exchequer.
Even
the
though it's written down, yes, yes.
Tony, comms check, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, I can hear you fine.
Roger that, loud and clear.
You happy? Diver two ready for the water.
Roger that, get the diver in the water, please.
I don't think I've ever been on a time team where it's taken me 2.5 days before I get to see the archaeology.
Reports well.
But now the moment has come. As I get closer, I'm trying to imagine all those medieval shipwrights putting her together. Why those mutinous sailors abandoned her. Maybe she wasn't struck by lightning. Perhaps they set fire to her on purpose to get all that precious iron out.
Phil to Tony, can you hear me? I'll press that down.
Phil to Tony, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Are you as amazed as you should be?
It's really fantastic. When I first got down, the visibility was just like being in a swimming pool. But there's so much of it here, Phil.
I know, it just seems so bizarre. I mean, we two who've actually seen it are giggling and bubbling to us over a couple of idiots.
Phil's absolutely right. You can't possibly tell how big she is until you get down here. Now I can see for myself the massive frame timbers, with the side of the ship disappearing away. The ballast, I assume, as there's no other reason for flints to be in here. And until you see how close together these enormous timbers are that step down towards the stern, you can't appreciate the scale of this ship. Archaeologically, John's made great progress this weekend, and he's made yet another discovery.
The surprise this morning was when we followed the frames back north to the other side of the ship, and it appears to me as though we have a series of truly massive, crooked, grown floor timbers, sort of big Y-shaped timbers, standing on the keel.
That sounds extremely plausible to me. It's like
some later 17th century ships, these big Y-shaped timbers. That's really interesting information.
Yeah, I hardly dare say this, but this does look to me very similar to those grown floor timbers at the bow of the Mary Rose, over.
Yes, I'm not surprised. That would be, I think, the most likely option, you know, within
the sort of medieval mindset.
The crooked timbers at the stern of the Grâce Dieu, which John has just discovered, were cut from trees specially picked by the shipwrights. The shape of the timber gave the ship's frame far greater strength in one piece than if separate timbers were joined together at the keel. This is the first time John's ever seen anything as enormous as this. Damien's run out of time. His experiment isn't finished, but the process has revealed some surprising insights into medieval shipbuilding on this scale.
We've learned things like that these absolutely massive nails, which are basically four times the size of your average medieval ship nail, just can't be worked the same way that the smaller nails can be. I think they may well have actually got blacksmiths to cut them individually off the ship before they use them, because cutting them off the ship's a lot quicker.
And then chase these in?
And then they might recess them in where they had to. If the nails were square, they wouldn't need to do that.
Given the historical evidence we've got, Damien, for the sheer quantity of materials involved in building this ship and how big it was, how tough do you think it would have been working on it?
Everything about this ship, the size of it, the laminations, the nails, the weight of everything, the loads of tar and moss everywhere, it's complicated, it's difficult. I don't think it would have been a popular ship to work on myself.
So perhaps they'd have started off thinking they could just scale up, and it became more difficult the minute they started trying to do it.
I think all the shipwrights were schooled in a simpler tradition, which ultimately goes right back to the Iron Age, and they were struggling in new circumstances, having to build enormously bigger ships. Cannons were coming in, oceanic voyages and so on, and really the technology wasn't up to that. My view is that it's really a bit of a technological dead end.
The Grâce Dieu heralded the end of the great clinker ships. By the time Henry VIII launched the Mary Rose nearly 100 years later, the old clinker technology had given way to a radically different carvel design, using parallel boards fixed edge to edge onto a rigid frame. This morning, Francis and Stuart started to look for the medieval shoreline in Bursledon. One of their targets was the remains of a storehouse near the old dried-up creek.
Francis, I reckon this must be the most impressive rhubarb plant in England. I hope your archaeology is as exciting.
Well, actually, it is, Tony. This is the storehouse. We've gone down and we've hit lots of rocks. And I think these are footings for walls or something like that. We don't know what date they are. But next door,
right,
dug a little hole and came up with this. Now, that makes me very excited. It's a bit of pottery dated about 1450. So that is right on the money for the Grâce Dieu. And then we've also found in that trench a large-headed nail that could be something to do with ships, but we don't know for sure yet.
What does it tell us?
Well, what it tells us is what Burselden is in the late 15th century. Burselden seems to be, I mean, I think we're right in our original assumptions, between there and just beyond the main road which exists today. So that's the Burselden of the 16th century with the creek out in front of it.
So if Stuart's right, this dried-up creek just by the church could have been at the heart of medieval Burselden and the centre of a royal shipbuilding business which would grow and diversify for centuries to come, or at least until the railways came along. Carenza has discovered that the practicalities of building the Grace Dieu were astounding. It's a remarkable testament to the courage and ambition of those medieval shipwrights.
I mean, what's really struck me is the sheer quantities of everything that was required to build it. I mean, there's thousands of gallons of tar and pitch are needed to waterproof it, 38 tonnes of rope for the sails, never mind anything else for the sails. There's 23 tonnes of iron required to make 52,000 pounds of nails. That's just the nails on the ship.
And that's without the acres of timber that you need to hold together.
I mean, the figures for that are unbelievable, aren't they? 2,735 oak trees, 1,145 beech trees. Now, at a tonne and a half per tree, you know, that's over 6,500 tonnes of wood. Just moving that around must have been phenomenal. And that doesn't include all the timber that came from abroad.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, some of it came from the Baltic. You've got wainscot boards, and you've got regals, which are timber from Riga, and you've got Prussian deal, which, again, is all from the Baltic, coming into the east coast ports here.
And then there's the fitting out, the anchors. It's got 24 anchors, and the largest one is 17 feet
That anchor had a name. It was called Tinctor, and it survives in the royal accounts right up to the time of Henry VII.
Over the 3 days, we've discovered a lot more about the Grace Dieu. From the sonar geophysics, we think that she measured about 120 feet long at the keel. And when you take into account the overhanging bow and stern, she was probably longer than 200 feet. And there's no doubt that she was very broad, over 50 feet at the widest point. John's discovered a lot of new technical information, from the length of the hull planking to the sizes and arrangement of the stern timbers. As a ship, we can't say if she was a success or a failure, because through no fault of her own, the Grace Dieu was a battleship without a war. There's no doubt that if she'd gone out in anger, she could have overpowered her enemies, but would she have lasted the ravages of the wind and the sea? That we shall never know.
This was always going to be a difficult shoot, what with the untried technology, and the very fast-flowing river, and the bad visibility. And there were times when I thought we weren't going to get anywhere. But actually, we know far more about the Grace Dieu than we did 3 days ago. And that's why we came here. The rest of the time team have gone home, but I've got to have just one more look.
Left surface.
Grab two left surface.
Roger that.